Okay, now, if you've listened to Coast on a regular basis, you know the name Stanton Friedman for a number of reasons as well. Former nuclear physicist, one of the most influential voices in ufology since the 1960s. He has written a new book with Kathleen Martin called Science Was Wrong, and here he is back on Coast to Coast as we wake him up from the East Coast, no doubt. Stanton, how are you?
Yeah, you do wake me up, George. Remember, I'm 4 hours ahead of you.
Yeah, you sure are. But, man, you've got the energy, Stan. You don't give up.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I got so many different things going, you'd think I was 20 years younger. Well, make it 30 years younger.
Hey, Kathleen's going to join us in about 15 minutes, but I wanted to take a little bit of time to talk with you about today. I mean, I'm perusing the Internet, doing my research on so many things, and finally, there you are on a mainstream cable news outlet's website, Fox News. AOL News did a story on you as well, and it was picked up. It's about time. I was impressed.
Well, you know, I was, too, when I found out one of your guests is past guest, Lee Spiegel, AOL News, and he called me earlier today, said, "Hey, Stan, 400,000 hits on that article."
I love it.
And he was high, too. His boss liked it, too. So, and then, you know, I've been putting it off, and I guess I got to begin. I'm going to be doing something with the International Metaphysical University. They have on sort of online courses, you know.
You're going to teach, aren't you?
I think so, and it should be fun. You know, I've never been a professor at a university. People keep calling me professor, but I've spoken at 600 colleges and universities.
That's how I first met you back in 1971.
In Michigan,
you
of all
got it.
Places.
Yep.
And neither one of us are there anymore.
I go back to see my folks, but...
Yeah, I get through there once in a while on the way to someplace else usually, but to get to the Far East Coast, which is where I am. But, you know, and we got this movie thing we're going to announce the details on in Roswell, New Mexico on July 2nd. I love the title, Magic Men, M-A-J-I-C.
Perfect.
You know, tune in next month to hear about it. But, you know, it's funny. You think of who's going to play me in the movie? And somebody said, Dustin Hoffman. I said, well, I'd settle for that.
Dustin, who would play you?
I have no idea.
That's an interesting possibility. Who would that be?
I don't know. And it won't be a handsome guy. It'll be a smart guy, I hope.
Anthony Hopkins would do a great job.
Ooh, there's a possibility. Yeah. I'll put him on the list.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Hey, tell me, what's going on in the field of ufology these days, Stan?
Well, there's a certain amount of confusion. There's a certain amount of, you know, the same as usual kind of thing. There's Roswell coming up, and I'll be down there as usual. Kathleen will be there, too, both giving lectures and the big festival event, July 1st through the 5th. There's the MUFON conference, and MUFON in Denver later in July, the 23rd, 24th, 25th. I'm looking forward to, my book just came out, but Science Was Wrong. But there's another book coming out by Bryce Zabel and Richard Dolan, and you've had Richard on, and Bryce was on.
And Bryce has been on, sure.
After Disclosure, AD, After Disclosure, and that raises all those questions. I'm anxious to see the book because I keep getting asked, hey, you think Disclosure is going to happen, you know, next month, next year, when, and what will it mean, and all this kind of stuff, and that's a complicated subject. But, you know, this past year we've had two major stories that got a lot of attention dealing with aliens, would you believe? I'll add my noise as a third, but the British Royal Institute, you know, had one, they had a big conference about aliens and searching for alien life and all this stuff in January in London. And then Dr. Stephen Hawking with his strange comments about Columbus and look what he did to the natives.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were comments all over the place. It's almost as if the world is in such a mess. Let's talk about something interesting and off to the side here. No oil on those aliens.
Man, what a situation. You know, that may be one of the subjects when we get into your book, When Science Was Wrong, when next hour. because when it does go wrong, it goes wrong in a big way.
Big, big way. And although I heard somebody, very sad, CBC up here in Canada, you know, does a great job on news and stuff. And there's a guy out of Nigeria. They have oil spills like that all the time. But the company and the government are in bed with each other, you might say, and who they don't care about the people at all.
No.
And it, this, when I think about it, the oil spill in the Gulf could come right around Florida and right up the coast and finally get over here in New Brunswick, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, that's very possible. And, you know, and today the big story on the Internet about you, of course, was the so-called, the phrase you've used so eloquently before, the cosmic Watergate.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've got some people who want to talk to me about that coming up, too. And, you know, I've been using it for how many years, George?
A long time. A long time.
It, you know, maybe people are beginning to recognize that not always do the powers that be tell us the truth. I'm thinking of BP and this minor spill down there and things like that, you know. So maybe they're getting to the point where, gee whiz, what's going on? Maybe the government is covering up about UFOs. I mean, there's no question in my mind, but and I can't hold my blacked out and whited out documents close to the telephone, and you still won't see them.
your book with Kathleen, Science Was Wrong, that is not an effort to steer away from ufology, is it?
No, for you? No. It's an outgrowth of the fact that over the years I have found that, somewhat to my surprise, that it wasn't only in the field of ufology that strange things have been said by smart people, which have stood in the way of progress. And there are several medical stories in there, some of them rather heartbreaking, frankly, for the people involved. And it seemed a good time to look at the bigger picture here and also to get away from a niche book, if you will, you know, flying saucers, UFOs, oh, well. But Science Was Wrong, you know, and there's no question mark in our book. It's exclamation point. So there are two chapters about UFOs. Kathleen did one on abductions, on which she is quite an expert, Betty Hill's niece.
Well, you wrote a book, Captured, with her, right?
Yes, and she did most of the work. Let's give her credit. And she wrote half the chapters in this book, mostly the medical chapters. She has strong medical interest. I stayed fairly close to the hard technology stuff, space and aviation. And, you know, there are whole books about stupid things smart people have said, but they don't usually look at the implications. They'll quote somebody and you'll laugh and say, oh, gee, that was a stupid thing to say, wasn't it? And go on. But what we've tried to point out in the book, and it seems appropriate now with the BP and all this stuff, and some of the epidemics we've heard about, or pandemics, or whatever you want to call them, it seems important to recognize that science is an institution that needs oversight just like all the other ones do. And, you know, climate change, if some people had their way, we'd spend, $800 billion this year to try to get everybody off, stop putting out evil CO2 and all this kind of stuff. And one recognizes that, hey, it's been way overblown. We don't have really a Supreme Court of all the stuff that's being published that's supposedly scientific that isn't. And we need to recognize that because the world is so interconnected, you know, there's a chapter in the book about smallpox, and, you know, how it helped defeat the natives in South America and all that sort of stuff. But now we have an interconnected world. You can move disease, you know, a few airplanes carrying people with the wrong stuff.
Absolutely.
Spread around the world. Yep. You can't say, instantly, oh, that's happening over there. Who cares? You know, now it's a world. The world is interconnected. We all need to be concerned about what everybody is doing. We hopefully could learn from it, too. And, you know, that was one of the things about Stephen Hawking's comments about what Columbus did to the natives.
Don't invite the aliens. You never know what they'll do to us.
Yeah, except the aliens didn't have weapons of mass destruction and ICBMs and the internet and reconnaissance satellites and moving out into space and all that stuff. If you were an alien, George.
And I may be, Stan.
Well, I didn't say you weren't. You wouldn't want us out there.
No.
We're a threat to the neighborhood.
That's right.
And behavior tells us that.
That's right.
We don't need to look around before.
I would say this planet, these inhabitants are not ready to come out into the cosmic group.
Boy, you're right about that. And it surprises people that they don't often take into account how young we are compared to the age of the neighborhood.
Exactly.
You know, first flight. 1903, for goodness sakes. That was yesterday.
I was going to say, over the last 100 years, our growth with technology has been incredible, yet I don't see that same kind of pace over the next 100 years. You know, we're 10 years into it, and I don't see anything dramatic. Do you?
Yeah, I think nanotechnology is going to have some things. I think biology with, God forbid, I should say it, creating life on our own. Would you trust the people on this planet to do a good job of that?
No. Well, look what they've done with the oil spill. They've severed the planet, for crying out loud.
I mean, that's going to go down in history as one of those strange events. How could it get this bad? How could we stand around and watch? And how could we believe the guys who are going to pay the bill, we hope, that they sort of got things under control. And what we really need is people looking over the shoulder of the media, asking the questions, not serving soothing syrup, if you will, all over the place. And so, you know, I haven't left ufology, and
and you're not going to.
No, I have no intention of, and this movie Magic Men, and of course I'll be teaching it at the Metaphysical University. All of these are ufological, if you will, but ufology is part of a larger picture, and I have to keep remembering that from time
to time. Well, you know, this field needs you, Stanton, and you know, I met you in 1971. I was 21. You were what, 60 then? I'm kidding.
Come on.
But
I was 37, George.
But you know, I've always said, and I want you to take this as the highest compliment, that when J. Allen Hynek passed away, nobody was around to fill his shoes except you, and you stepped in. You stepped in with the credibility, with the drive, with the knowledge. And we've got great researchers, as you well know, the Don Schmitz, the Kevin Randalls, the Richard Dolans, the Bud Hopkins. You know, these people are out there doing a good job. You know, the late John Mack. But you, Stan, I see truly as the father figure of all this. And we need you, those of us who just love this field, who want to get answers, because, you know, you're out there. I mean, I've seen you with me on Larry King's show when all others are fighting and arguing. I mean, you stand your ground and you're intelligent. You just say it the way it is. And this field of ufology needs you. So I'm glad you're plugging ahead with it.
Well, I appreciate that. And although I noticed, you know, after that show with Larry King, I did do a debate on your show.
With Seth Shostak, and you whipped him.
And Michael
and
Shermer,
Shermer,
even worse,
yeah.
Yes. And now I know one guy, Paul Davies, who's turned me down for a debate on your show. Now, I wonder why that is.
Because you win all the time. When people vote, they all vote for you.
Well, and because he knows he hasn't done his homework, too, I think. That's one of the things that some of the big shots in science aren't accustomed to having people say, hey, wait a minute, that's not right. What you just said isn't true. And some people don't want to have to put up with that. What we're dealing with here, too, is institutionalization. The same with the global warming kind of thing. There are research grants. There are people who are living off these activities, and they don't want any boat rocking going on. They're happy in their glory. And we've seen, you know, the climate gate
Yeah.
And we haven't heard the end of that story.
No, not at all. They want to get their grants, their funding, and be left alone, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And so somebody out there like me, I don't have to worry about what my institution says about me. You know, you're going to lose tenure, Stan, if you keep talking. You know, I'm my own boss.
Hey, Bill Burns is doing an article on Benjamin Simon, the psychiatrist who chatted with the Hills back in their abduction case. And I had interviewed him, Stan, back in 71, not too much later after I had chatted with you. I interviewed him by phone, and Bill wanted to know if I remembered whether he said that the, you know, Hills were, you know, off their rocker or what. And what I distinctly remember him saying was he cannot attest to the truth because he wasn't there. But what he did say was the Hills believe what happened to them was true. And to me, that's a major, major story.
Well, it was, yes. And we know, look, I read Dr. Simon's notes on the Fuller manuscript for The Interrupted Journey, and he was hard on John Fuller, making sure he got things straight.
Yep.
You know, you can't say this, you can't say that, you ruin my reputation if you say this. And he was, he had a strong pencil going on that one. And so he couldn't come out four square, but he certainly gave no indication of thinking that the Hills were confabulating or anything like
that's
that.
Right. That's absolutely
and
right.
I wish every abduction case had somebody like Simon, who didn't know about UFOs, but he knew a lot about people who'd had traumatic experiences.
This one puzzled him, didn't it?
It sure
this
did.
This case.
Well, there's no precedent for it. There'd been no other abduction case that got any publicity at all. There had been other abduction cases, but nobody knew about them, and especially in South America and other places, but the ABB case and others. And, of course, after the book came out, then we found out about a lot of them. But this whole question of fear of ridicule applies on the level of the people who have the experiences as well as on the level of the people who investigate the experiences. Don't tell my colleagues that I'm looking into this, you know. And isn't it strange that in this modern high-tech world, that's what we're concerned about?
Was it difficult for you in the early days of ufology when you know, you were a physicist and you decided, you know what, I'm going into this field full-time, I'm going on the lecture circuit, and I'm going to talk about it? Was it difficult for you? I mean, did you face ridicule?
I worried about it. Let's put it that way. I gave my first lecture in 67. I kept doing more lectures. And it was the enthusiastic response of professional groups, this Engineering Society of Detroit, to get back to Michigan.
That's right.
They were sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk.
And you
not
know what?
One negative question.
And you had people from Ford, General Motors, engineers there. That place was stacked with professionals who wanted to know about this subject.
Hey, look, I spoke at Los Alamos National Laboratory, the local chapter of the American Nuclear Society. We had 500 people. And again, no negative questions.
No, not at all. Well, take this break here, Stan. We're going to come back with you and Kathleen Martin as we talk about Science Was Wrong. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. We'll be right back. And the ever-enterprising webmaster Lex Lonehood has a link for you on our Twitter feed, Stanton's Friedman's online UFO class. So that's all there for you if you want to go take a look. Let me introduce Kathleen Martin here for a second. Scientific ufologist Kathleen has engaged herself in UFO abduction research and investigation for more than 20 years. She is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill and the conservator of their extensive UFO collection. Kathleen was a primary witness to the evidence of their 1961 UFO encounter and the aftermath. And for 10 years, Kathy served on the MUFON Board of Directors as the Director of Field Investigator Training. Here she is on Coast to Coast. Hey, Kathleen, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, thank you very much. I'm fine.
We have done many nights talking about you and your work on this program, so it's good to talk with you. And, of course, he's with us. There's Stanton over there. Come on back, Stan.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning, Stan.
So tell me about how you two first got together on Captured, and then let's get into Science Was Wrong.
Well, I think that I had known Stan for many, many years and had a great deal of respect and admiration for his work. I had attended many of his lectures and had even met him at my Aunt Betty's house one time when they were doing a joint television interview. But I, Betty had died. She died in 2004. And for several years, I had been working on my book, Captured. And I was writing about Betty's and Barney's experience from the point of view of a sociologist. And it occurred to me that the book would be strengthened by having the input of a physical scientist. So I started to think about who I should ask.
Well,
we all know that Stan had a great deal of involvement in the star map and a great deal of knowledge about the Hill case. And it just so happened that after Betty's death, the two of us were invited to appear on a television program that was being filmed in New Hampshire's White Mountains. This was, I believe, in June of 2005. And the end result was that we were both very unhappy about the way the program handled the Betty and Barney Hill case. Okay. It misrepresented it in many ways. And I think we started a battle together against the message that was being delivered by this program and did much writing together against that. And it was at the MUFON symposium in August of 2005 that I approached Stan and asked him if he would be interested in joining me in writing this book, Captured. And he said that he'd think about it. In the end, he ended up visiting my husband and myself in New Hampshire. I lived in New Hampshire at that time, and I'm in Florida now.
And that's where your aunt lived, right?
She lived in New Hampshire,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I had all of her files. I had the hypnosis tapes. This is 40 years worth of files and hours of interviews that I had done with Betty. All of the original investigation reports. So I had a wealth of information. And Stan came down and we talked over a period of days as he went through all of my materials and read my manuscript. And in the end, he told me that he would be interested in joining me in doing this because I was approaching it in an unbiased manner.
Right.
And he was impressed by that.
That's very important to him,
yes.
Stan. And Stan, when you met Kathleen and you were looking at this, these documents and this history from Betty Hill, I know, knowing you, you must have been going, this is a treasure chest of information.
Oh, no question about that. And I hadn't fully appreciated the fact that, I mean, I'd looked at John Fuller's files, as I mentioned earlier when you talked about Ben Simon, but I hadn't appreciated the fact that he had only used some of the tapes. Here, Kathy had transcribed all of the tapes of those sessions. And so, and I was angry at this company that we dealt with. Can you imagine an ad in the paper for a television program saying, I had sex with an alien, Stanton Friedman.
National Enquirer, right?
No, it was in a big newspaper,
yeah.
And I was really irked, to say the least.
Of course.
So it seemed reasonable that we could come at the problem of how to deal with a case like this from two quite different directions, as we have very different backgrounds. And it turned out that worked out very well, we thought, and Captured is still doing well. And we've had a good response from lots of people in lots of places, you know, not just a small group of pro-UFO people, but others who say, gee, I didn't know that, and that's intriguing. Now, I will say one thing, that, and I have to say it publicly, because my name is first on the book, as it is on the second one, I was given more credit than I deserved. You know, And the first book, Kathy did almost all the work, and I was shocked when I got the first cut of the cover and saying, hey, you can't put my name first. This is Kathy's book. Well, we got a simple answer, and there's no way to respond to this other than go ahead, and that was the book will sell much better, Stan, if your name is first because you're better known. Now, what do I say to that?
Exactly. Hey, I go through that, too, because, you know, I've written two books with Bill Burns, whom you both know.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bill does extensive work in research. He's the legs of all our books. And they did the same thing. And but that's what a publisher does, I guess.
Now, in the new book, I should say that we each wrote half the chapters, seven each. Seven's a good number. I like the number seven. And Kathy did the medical stuff. I mean, we talked with other things. But we don't live next door to each other. Thank goodness for computers and
email. Oh, that has made it easy, hasn't it?
Oh, heck of a lot easier.
Absolutely. You email chapters back and forth and everything else.
Yeah.
Kathy, let me ask you this in just a few minutes that we have this hour, and then we're going to dive in for the next couple hours after this with you and Stan's work, Science Was Wrong. At any point when you were with Betty, did you look for ways to say, this didn't happen, I want to see her face, I want to see how she reacts, or was this something that you believed from her from the get-go?
I played devil's advocate with Betty over and over again in the sessions that I had, the tape-recorded sessions, where I interviewed her. And I am naturally a skeptical person. I'm willing to accept the evidence when I have the evidence at hand. But I looked for alternative explanations for what might have happened to Betty and Barney. Perhaps it was only Betty's dream account, those troubling dreams that she had for five nights about 2 weeks after the close encounter in the White Mountains with the UFO. And perhaps, I thought, Barney might have overheard those dreams, although it wasn't intentional. Perhaps he overheard her talking to somebody else about them. Perhaps he unconsciously or subconsciously absorbed that information, and perhaps he repeated that information as a fantasy in hypnosis. So my comparative analysis, actually, the reason I transcribed those tapes was to conduct a comparative analysis to determine whether or not Betty's and Barney's statements were identical to those in Betty's dreams, or if they were different.
Kathleen, you talk about synchronicities, because one of the reasons that I got involved in broadcasting and to unravel these kinds of stories was because of Betty and Barney Hill. When my mother brought home one day the Look magazine article about them, I was hooked. I couldn't get away with it. It got me into broadcasting. It got me to interview Stanton Friedman as my very first one-on-one interview. I couldn't stop. This was a story that keeps coming up in my life and my career, and the fact that you were so close to it is for me is just absolutely incredible.
It was an extremely interesting story, and I became hooked, too, after I ended my professional career back in the late 80s. I spent 15 years researching and investigating this case. I went to along the close encounter route. I went to the abduction site over and over again, and I drove at the rate of speed that Betty and Barney reported that they drove at. I stopped at their stops. I stayed there and tried to reenact what they were going through. I looked for any plausible alternative explanation for what might have happened to them, and I wasn't able to find one. And Dr. Simon didn't do the extensive kind of investigation that I did, but he challenged Betty and Barney under hypnosis for another explanation. As he did with all of his patients, because oftentimes there is an underlying reason why people are troubled. Dr. Simon worked with shell shock victims during World War II, and he was very, very successful in using this technique. He wasn't able to come up with another plausible reason.
He was baffled by this, wasn't he?
He was. Yes, he was.
Stan, this case, you know, after Look magazine came out with it, and then Fuller's work, and it just kept growing and growing, did it become the focal point for ufology during the 60s?
I don't think so. Not really. For a part of ufology, part of it was that NICAP, one of the two major organizations, really didn't hold much interest in abductions. It was like there are these alien spacecraft flying around, but there ain't nobody on board.
Yeah, and they're definitely not picking people up, right?
Right. And so part of this is because of the contactee movement, and there was fear of being associated with them, the Georgia Damskis,
sure,
and so forth. And so NICAP wanted to keep Lily White, so to speak, and stayed away from this kind of stuff. And there were other things going on. The Condon report was going on. And so this case, I mean, it was interesting that the television movie, the UFO incident starring James Earl Jones, wasn't done until 1975. The book came out 10 years earlier.
Yeah, that's right.
And so there was this long gap, and I feel very fortunate. I was living in Pittsburgh, just beginning to sort of blossom out in ufology, and I had a call from the radio station on which I had made my first public appearance about UFOs, telling me, I love the name of the show I was on, Contact. They told me, it was very unusual for them to do this, that Betty and Barney were coming to town. Maybe I'd want to talk to them. And they told me where they were staying. They were doing a television show. And so I called, and we had dinner. We spent 3 hours together, and that was only 3 months before Barney's death. But I've seen Betty, as Kathy mentioned, at her home and stuff, and we've done television shows. But getting a chance to see the two of them, just the three of us, gave me a good reason for being interested in this case. And then I was lucky again. Coral Lorenzen of APRO, the other group, major group, which was more interested in beings and abductions and so forth, I had a call from Coral Lorenzen, the co-director, about a woman named Marjorie Fish, who was working on the star map.
Yeah.
And she wanted to work with a scientist, and was I interested? And I said, sure. And so I called, and I met with Marjorie. I was traveling a great deal. And I was with her when she made a presentation to Alan Hynek in Chicago.
And the star map was based on Betty's hypnosis, right? Of what they told her where they were from, right?
Well, they didn't tell her a place. They showed her
a
three-dimensional model, a bunch of points of light connected with lines, supposedly trade routes, heavy trade routes, light trade routes, occasional expedition. And this came out under hypnosis. And fortunately, Dr. Simon asked if she could remember what it looked like. And she said yes. So he gave her a post-hypnotic suggestion. If and only if she could remember it accurately, please draw it later on. And she did, went home and did it and brought it in a few weeks later. And it shows up in The Interrupted Journey. And that got Marjorie interested, who didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But talked to Betty, visited Betty, and then went back and did a remarkable piece of work building 27 three-dimensional models and so forth. But so I was in on that right from the start. And as a matter of fact, the first article to be published about that work was by myself and a Los Angeles-based writer, Bobby Ann Slate Gironda, no longer with us, unfortunately, in Saga Magazine, everybody's favorite publisher.
Oh, sure.
But so I was very fortunate in being brought in on this from the side, and I remember somebody was upset at me for making some comments, who said, well, you didn't have anything to do with that case. And when I rattled off the fact that I had met Barty, that I was the first to publish about the star map and so forth, met with Marjorie Fish, been at Betty's home and stuff, then he stepped back and said, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that.
Are you convinced at this point, Stan, that based on Marjorie Fish's star map and Betty's hypnosis, where she pinpointed these stars, that whatever happened to them, and let's just say they were abducted by ETs, that they came from that star system?
Well, came from maybe, I don't know whether they're based there or from, that's the home of operations for a whole network of solar systems that are interconnected, you know. And I don't know whether these guys traipse around and go out and back or are stationed 2 years here and 2 years there, you know, and so forth. But, yeah, I think they're connected with that place. And remember, there are disputes about the star map work, of course, because our astronomical information is much better now than it was back then. But remember, this is the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our entire local neighborhood. Now, our star, the sun, is 4.3 light years away from the next star over. These two stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, are only an eighth of a light year apart. So they're more than 30 times closer to each other.
Yeah.
We're out in the boonies. These guys got next door neighbor. And, oh, yes, they're a billion, with a B, a billion years older than the sun. And so they've had a little more time than we have to develop interstellar travel and a lot more excuse because you got a next-door neighbor to visit. So, you know, I don't know what – I haven't been to Zeta Reticuli. I don't know what's going on out there. But remember, they're only 39 light years away. So when I get people saying, oh, look how much energy to get to the next galaxy over Andromeda is 2 million light years away. Frankly, I don't care about Andromeda.
People always think of today's propulsion systems when you talk about space travel. They can't do that. They have to think that whatever is...
tomorrow's.
Yeah, exactly.
Millennium.
Well, we're going to take this break. We're at the hour. We're going to continue talking with Kathleen Martin and Stanton Friedman about both their works captured in their new book, Science Was Wrong. Lots to talk about when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Martin. Kathleen, give us an overview of Science Was Wrong.
Well, Science Was Wrong is a book that Stan and I wrote about startling truths about cures, theories, and inventions that they declared impossible. And they is, in many cases, the scientific establishment. And what we do is we explore the reasons for this. In 14 chapters, we each wrote 7 chapters, and the book is divided into a number of different sections, 5 different sections. Stan wrote about aerospace, technology. I wrote 3 chapters on medicine. We both wrote about politics. I wrote 2 chapters there, and he wrote 1, global warming, man or nature. And then we have a last section called The Frontiers of Science, in which I explored psi phenomena and the conundrum of alien abduction, and Stan wrote about UFOs. So we have a variety of topics on different issues, but in each case, something went wrong. And these subjects were debunked. They weren't accepted by the scientific establishment, often for political reasons or as a result of greed or egos, and sometimes religion even got in the way.
You both hold science in a high regard, so you're not poking at science, are you?
No, we're not at all.
No.
We are actually exploring the reasons why science sometimes fails. In the long run, in all of our chapters, there was a happy ending that these new, very sound scientific discoveries were eventually accepted. But the unfortunate part is that the denial of this good scientific work by the scientific establishment held up progress. And in some cases, hundreds, if not thousands, of people died as a result.
Stan, let's bring up cold fusion at this point as an example. You've got your very tough views on cold fusion. How does science react to that?
Well, I haven't heard many things back from science about that one yet. I'm waiting. The fact of the matter is that, yes, it was badly handled when it was first put out by Pons and Fleischmann, a big public announcement instead of an article in a scientific journal. That automatically turned an awful lot of people off. It was not directly reproducible all the time. They had this remarkable claim that you could take, call it a magic bottle, that had heavy water, curium oxide, and palladium, a fairly dense, peculiar metal. And by running a current through this device, you'd get more energy out than you put in, with the implication being that nuclear fusion was going on inside the palladium, where the heavy water, the deuterium, heavy hydrogen, was locked in, so to speak. Palladium is a great thing for absorbing an enormous amount of hydrogen. And so the noise went out. Some people tried a quick reproduction. There wasn't a scientific article to refer to, unfortunately. And it got blasted from all directions. Now, fortunately, there were some people who found that, they did get an effect. There was some energy coming off there. Now, the kicker here was, the notion was that nuclear fusion, which is what goes on in the sun and all the stars, has to involve very high temperatures and pressures. And, you know, how could you have a little device sitting on your desk that produced energy from nuclear fusion? There weren't any high temperatures or anything like that. So it seemed intuitively to be obvious that this couldn't be real, despite the fact that the measurements in some cases indicated it was. So it went through ups and downs. These guys got hounded out. Pons and Fleischmann both got basically hounded out of their jobs. And fortunately, there were some people like the Navy, like the Electric Power Research Institute, like Toyota, who looked at this stuff and said, you know, why don't we look at this more carefully? And when they did, they began to get good results too. And so as time went on, the percentage of experiments in which there was a net production of energy grew and grew. But that didn't stop the nasty, noisy negativists, I can use the same phrase here as I do in the UFO world, from attacking. Remember, the basic rules for debunkers of anything are, don't bother me with the facts, my mind's made up, I've taken a stand and I'm not going to change, you know. And the second, of course, is what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. For example, if you have fusion reactions going on, even at these low temperatures, there ought to be neutrons produced. And the question is, are there or aren't there? Well, it turns out there have been several papers published saying, indeed, there aren't neutrons produced. And there's a whole bunch of these other things that went on that turned out to be, in spite of the noisy negatives, to be true. So I anticipate this is an area where we're going to hear a lot more. And people need to recall that it takes an enormous amount of time, money, effort to go from, you know, tabletop devices to major facilities. I shocked somebody the other day when I said the Manhattan Project to develop nuclear weapons cost $2 billion in 1942 money. And, you know, that's an enormous amount of money. So you can't say, oh, I got a good idea. Let's go down the basement. We'll build something, and next month we'll sell it. That's not how it works when you've got really new technology. And heavy water is expensive, and palladium is expensive. So you don't do experiments very easily. But some of the attacks were really stinko science, if I can coin a phrase. And I want other people to be looking at this. As a matter of fact, the SSE Journal has a whole issue in recent months devoted to low-energy nuclear reactions. That sounds much better than cold fusion.
Yeah. Now, tell me a little bit of your relationship with Carl Sagan.
Well, it's kind of strange. I grew up in Linden, New Jersey. He grew up in the next-door town, Rahway, New Jersey. We didn't know each other then, but these were, you know, we played football. Our schools played football against each other, and so we're the same age. I'm 4 months older, I guess. And we met one time at a summer camp while we were still in high school. Anyway, I went to the University of Chicago in 1953, and he was already there. Chicago was strange at that time. They took kids right out of high school. You could do 2 years of high school and then go over to the college of the University of Chicago.
Ready to go. Okay.
Yeah, get an early start. So if it just turns out that for 3 years we were in essentially all the same classes in the physics department at the University of Chicago. We suffered through some of the same poor professors and some of the same good professors. Chicago was going through a transition then, too. And so we got to know each other quite well at that time. And we've had contact since then. I mean, Carl died, of course, in the 90s. But I was at his home less than 2 years before that. And I spoke at Cornell University a couple of times. And the last time, I was sponsored by the UFO Club, whose advisor was a professor of astronomy in Carl's department. So when I came to town, that professor picked me up and we went over to Carl's house and had cookies and coffee and so forth. And it was all quite cordial and friendly, and it was good to see him. He was mystified to some extent, I think. He knew my background. We were in classes together, and you know, how could I come down on the pro-UFO side, so to speak? And actually, I've been fairly strong in my criticisms of some of the things he's written about UFOs in his books and statements he's made on television, and an article in a Sunday supplement. Kathy, remember the name of that supplement?
Yes, Parade.
Parade, that's right.
Parade,
and,
sure.
You know, High Circulation magazine had an article about abductions focusing on the Hill case and got it all wrong. And this came out after he and I had this last meeting. And as a matter of fact, he sent me a copy, an advance copy, and I wrote a long, detailed critique of the article. He didn't pay any attention to that, but we had some more conversation. I was challenging him to a debate. But then I heard he was suffering from cancer, and I certainly stopped pushing him. He had other problems to worry about. But I have to give Carl credit for something. He did more than anybody else that I'm aware of, anyway, to get people interested in the whole notion of extraterrestrial intelligence. You know, there being life out there.
Well, and he was a believer that it was out there, right?
Yes, very definitely. And it's interesting that I mentioned that Bryce Zabel and I will be talking in Roswell about this new movie, Magic Men. Well, Bryce did Dark Skies, and in one of the last episodes, there was a character, Carl Sagan, who had been read in early on the truth about flying saucers with the agreement that he would always debunk. Now, that goes back to the late 90s, mind you.
Let me bring Kathleen in for a second here with this story. Kathleen, of all the chapters in this book, Science Was Wrong, you seem to really have a passion for the title, The Eugenics Movement in America. Tell me why.
When I was in college, I was studying psychology and sociology, social work, and in these classes, we were still discussing eugenics. It wasn't termed eugenics at that point. And that also came into a genetics course that I took, where the discussion was whether or not we should be sterilizing mentally retarded people, mentally ill people. In some states, it was still legal to do forced sterilizations on these people. And even in a genetics class, we talked about a study that was done that indicated that the sons of convicted felons often became convicted felons themselves. And it was believed that perhaps this was a trait, a genetic trait that was carried on. In the genetic, in the eugenics movement, it was called germplasm. It wasn't called genetics. And that this trait could be eliminated by sterilizing the sons of convicted felons and the convicted felons themselves. And it was quite a hot topic when I was in college. And when I think about all of this, and the more I have researched the eugenics movement, I find that it was so extensive that many of the people in my life would not have been here. I have a cousin who is deaf, and Stan has a daughter who is deaf. They're both college-educated, productive members of society. Had the eugenics movement succeeded, there's a good chance that they would not have been here. And if they still were, they both would have been sterilized. And probably all of the members of my family would have been sterilized because one deaf person was born into our family. So this really hits home with me.
Well, it's
also,
it's
when you think about Dan's family coming from Lithuania and the Hitler's regime in Eastern Europe, the members of his family who were exterminated by Hitler really drives home a point to me. And so I am very passionate about this.
Tell me a little bit, Kathleen, because of your experience with Betty Hill, of what you wrote about the conundrum of alien abduction. Tell me about that and the variety of disorders that some people try to associate with that.
Yes, in the conundrum of alien abduction, I examined the academic studies that have been done in an attempt to explain why some people believe they've been abducted when allegedly they have not. And the thing that really interested me in the beginning is where this whole notion came from, that we're going to fund sociological studies instead of funding physical science studies of UFO evidence. And it took me back to the Condon Committee, and I started to explore this, and I found that of the seven-member committee, there were four psychologists. There was one physicist, and that was Edward Condon, but we know that Condon took a negative view of UFOs in general, that he tended to focus on the lunatic fringe, and really didn't take a serious look at the whole, all of the UFO evidence.
And I think that was a setup from the get-go, don't you, Stan?
Well, it seems to have been. Somebody had to do something because of all the fuss about, the Michigan cases, as a matter of fact, swamp gas and all that sort of stuff, and more sightings come into play. So we got to do something, folks, to get the press and everybody else convinced that there's nothing to this. And we got to find somebody who'll take the right attitude, in quotes, and they found Condon. And it was hard to find somebody who would take on the study. There was quite a bit of money wound up spending $539,000, which for an academic institution is quite a bit. But their attitude was known right from the beginning, and Kathy has quoted in her in various places the memo that was written. Maybe people remember it from Look magazine. What was that? The trick has to be what, Kathy? You tell them.
Well, it is the trick memo, and I wanted to mention that one of the committee members was the assistant dean of the graduate school, Robert Lowe. He was the project coordinator, and to me this is very important because he wrote that it is not acceptable to study UFOs, that this is would be sort of an embarrassment to the college. And the trick would be to describe the project so that to the public it would appear to be a totally objective study, but to the scientific community would present the image of a group of non-believers trying their best to be objective but having almost zero expectation of finding a saucer. And he went on to write, "I can quite easily imagine, however, that psychologists, sociologists, and psychiatrists might well generate scholarly publications as a result of their investigations of saucer observers." And so it appears to me that this is the beginning of the shift from the academic study, the funding of projects to look at UFO evidence, such as Dr. James McDonald did, onto funding social science research projects to study not the evidence, but those who report observing UFOs.
Is it safe to say that the science, like the pandemic they claimed with the swine flu, was so wrong that it has disastrous effects?
Well, there's a couple of chapters in the book. One of my favorite people, Ignaz Semmelweis.
Let's talk about Ignaz when we come back. Stan, right before the break, you were telling us about one of your favorite portions of the book.
Yeah, about Ignaz Semmelweis. Kathy wrote the chapter. I had dug out the original story, which fascinated me. And here's a perfect example of a guy who figured out the science, figured out what was going on, but was kicked out of the hospital. Kathy, why don't you tell the story?
Okay. Ignaz Semmelweis lived from 1818 to 1865. He grew up in Pest in Hungary and then went on to medical school at the Vienna General in Vienna and taught medical students at the Vienna General Hospital. And at that time, the lying-in unit at the General Hospital had been divided into two sections. This was the largest teaching hospital in Europe. One section was for teaching medical students, while the other was for teaching midwives. The idea of introducing medical students into the specialty of obstetrics was fairly new at that time. And there was a problem in the hospital where rows of women would often become infected. And up to 2 weeks after childbirth, it was typically an infection in the uterus or the genital tract, and it became a systemic infection within hours. And the death rate was very, very high. And not only the women, but their infants also succumbed to this. It was a real problem in the medical hospitals throughout Europe. And by accident, really, Ignaz Semmelweis discovered that the contaminants that were causing this were brought on the hands of his students and himself, actually, from the mortuary.
Jeez.
Where they did the dissections in the morning into the lying-in unit in the afternoon, where these medical students would do internal examinations on these women. And often the exams were rough. They were inexperienced students. And women were subjected to several internal examinations over the course of the afternoon. Nobody washed their hands. Nobody realized that this bacterium, it was actually Streptococcus,
which they could never see, right?
Which they could not see, was carried on these medical students' hands. Semmelweis had a friend who was actually pricked by a scalpel during one of these dissections and became infected and ended up dying as a result of this infection, and his symptoms were exactly the same as the symptoms of all of these women and infants who had died. And Semmelweis introduced the very simple method of hand washing. He used lime water and insisted that all of his medical students, instead of simply wiping their hands on their bloody aprons before they did internal examinations, would wash their hands. As a result of this, Semmelweis ended up losing his job. He wrote about this. He did very good scientific recording of his results. He used good scientific protocols in doing laboratory experiments.
Why'd they dump him?
He wasn't playing the game the way he was supposed to.
The medical establishment throughout Europe was not willing to accept the idea that his theory was correct. They adhered to the milk metastasis theory that said that women were plumbed sort of incorrectly, and that the milk from their breast moved down into their uterus instead of operating the way that it should. And they thought that the pus that they found inside of these women was actually milk. There was the miasma theory, where they thought that it was putrid matter from swamps that was affecting these women and killing these women, and that there was absolutely nothing that they could do about it. The doctors at the time certainly didn't want to admit that their own hands, which were supposed to be healing these women, were actually killing them. And Dr. Semmelweis was called a charlatan. He was debunked throughout Europe for his entire lifetime. His theory was not accepted.
Now, Stan, you give me some examples. As you say, astronomers sometimes are the target in science was wrong.
Well, and I for good reason. Astronomers have taken, because they deal with the universe, and our concept of the universe has changed drastically over the last 100 years, less than that. They have spoken out and stood in the way of progress. The greatest astronomer, American astronomer of the 19th century, Simon Newcomb, made a strong statement in 1903, October, and the date's important, that all the evidence had shown that there would never be possible to fly a vehicle. That may be a balloon, but not a vehicle. This is 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight.
Yeah.
And there were on the other end, in 1956, a year before Sputnik, the British Astronomer Royal said that space travel is utter bilge. Nobody would spend the money, and it wouldn't be a sensible thing to do. And we should develop better instrumentation for astronomy. And yet the crazy thing is that astronomers have benefited more than any other group of scientists from the space program.
Absolutely. Hubble. Let's note the Hubble, right?
Yeah, and the Kepler and the Chandra and a whole bunch of others. And it's truly remarkable that we have to remember here, astronomers know nothing about advanced flight technology, space technology. They're not the guys who design the rockets or anything like that. And there's a long history of massive misunderstanding. My favorite, I have to tell you this. In 1941, a Canadian astronomer, Dr. Campbell, was sick and tired of all the science fiction stuff about going to the moon, you know, the pulp magazines and stuff. He was going to show that this made no sense. And so he did show that. He did a paper published in a scientific journal calculating the initial launch weight of a rocket able to get a man to the moon and back. Legitimate question. How big does the darn thing have to be? Bottom line, it would have to weigh 1,000,000 tons. Even for me, that's too big. Funny thing, 1969, still with a dumb old chemical rocket, we sent three guys to the moon and back. The initial launch weight of the rocket was 3,000 tons. He was off a factor of 300 million. Now, you talk about being wrong. because he didn't know anything about space travel. He hadn't studied the publications that were readily available to him. He assumed a single-stage rocket, too low a limit on acceleration, too low a limit on velocity of the stuff coming out the back end, assumed you had to provide all the energy, didn't seem to know anything about cosmic freeloading, as I call it. And so if you make enough stupid assumptions, you can come up with wrong conclusions. That's the basic notion there. And there are many other examples, but astronomers also try to pretend that they're experts on human behavior. Now, if you were listing experts on, on alien behavior, worse than that, experts on human behavior, astronomers would not rank high on your list of people, sociologists, psychiatrists, psychologists, maybe even lawyers. But astronomers? And yet they're going to tell us that aliens, if they were coming here, would contact us. They would have sent messages first and a whole bunch of other things, which make no sense. There would be no secrecy, as if every country wouldn't love to get its mitt on a flying saucer, of course, for military applications. So, yeah, they're the villains in my half of the book.
Stan, I wanted to get your take, too. Joseph Farrell says that in Roswell, that whatever crashed was Nazi technology, and that they crashed it here. What do you think of that?
Well, I wrote my monthly column for the MUFON Journal is about Farrell's book. It's over 500 pages. I did read the book, and he mentions me very often and quotes at great length my stuff. But he's basically wrong, as far as I can tell. He ignores the testimony of the witnesses involved with Roswell, and we are asked to believe that this was developed in Nazi Germany. The war ended in 1945. It wasn't used during the war. There's no question about that. And then suddenly they moved to Argentina, and they were flying these things to do reconnaissance in the United States. For what reason, I don't know. He doesn't give any. And how could they have developed it and not used it? And again, going back to money, it takes a lot of dough to develop new flight technology and to build a whole bunch of these things. We're not talking about one. You know, we can't say there was a crash at Roswell and that was Nazi, but everything else was something else. That makes no sense.
No.
So I don't buy it. I said so in my review. I'm waiting to hear from somebody saying, you're full of baloney. That'll happen.
And Kathleen, with you and your work with Captured, along with Stan.
Yes.
In your opinion, after everything you reviewed, what do you think happened to Betty and Barney Hill?
I think that Betty and Barney actually did have a close encounter with an unconventional flying object in New Hampshire's White Mountains. I know from the original report and from being there in the very beginning, being at their house within 2 days, from the descriptions that Betty and Barney gave to my parents, that they had conscious recollection of seeing this craft at less than 100 feet, hovering less than 100 feet silently above their vehicle. This was clearly an unconventional aircraft. Barney had conscious recollection of observing non-human entities in this vehicle in the field. He was greatly frightened by this. Something started to drop down out of the bottom of the craft. He was afraid he was going to be captured. They had conscious recollection of two series of beeping or buzzing sounds on the trunk of the vehicle as they sped down Route 3 in New Hampshire, the major north-south route in 1961, the craft in pursuit. This beeping and buzzing sound caused the car to vibrate, and it caused this feeling of a tingling feeling to pass through Betty's and Barney's bodies and cause them to feel sleepy. An important point here is that they had a period of what was called doorway amnesia at the time. They had full conscious recollection of the sounds on the trunk of the car, of Betty rolling down the window to look up to see if she could see this thing. And then the next thing they knew, they were 35 miles down the road. They hadn't spoken to each other. They had no recollection of what happened during that period of time, for those 35 miles. And when they arrived home, there was physical evidence that something bizarre had happened to them. I believe that they did have a real abduction. Perhaps it wasn't identical to all of Betty's memories under hypnosis, because some of her memories were very similar to her dreams. However, there was information that both Betty and Barty gave independently, and there's no way that they could have shared that information with each other. And that information leads me to believe that they were abducted. In my comparative analysis, I looked at statements that Betty and Marty independently made about the number of beings that might have been standing in a certain location, about their behavior, about their movements, about the sequential order in which things happened. And none of this was in Betty's infamous dream material. So, and what I found was statistical evidence, correlating data, that told me that at least part of this abduction has scientific backing, that there is scientific evidence in the form of social science that indicates to me this was a real experience. In addition to that physical evidence, I think that the tearing in Betty's dress is very, very significant. It isn't often emphasized. We talk about the pink powdery substance in Betty's dress. But when she arrived home, that dress that was a fairly new dress that she had worn, she spent the day seated in the passenger side of the vehicle. And when she arrived home, the zipper was torn at the top. The zipper fabric was torn 1 inch on one side and 2 inches on the other side. The dress was in fine condition when she put it on in the morning. When she took it off the following morning, it was torn. It was torn from waist to hemline. Well, possibly the lining could have become torn during the day, but that doesn't explain how the hem was torn down on that side of the dress, too. That indicates that some kind of struggle probably took place. And then we have to look at the tops of Barney's shoes. They were deeply scraped. They were so scraped that he, even though they were his dress shoes, he was never able to wear them for that purpose again.
Scraped or cut?
They were scraped. They were scraped. And he had to wear them for yard work after that. It was more than just being scuffed. They were scraped. And I have that in Barney's words.
Oh, what's the significance of that, Kate?
He was that a very careful dresser.
It means that he was dragged. And under hypnosis, he talked about being dragged. He described the sensation.
See, now that doesn't sound alien, does it, Stan? Because every case we hear, they're kind of floated, aren't they?
Well, in this case, they being on one side, being on the other side, Barney's eyes were closed. Remember, Barney had a gun. He was much more of a threat to them than Betty was. And so they physically removed him, and maybe they got smarter later on, you know. But there was no instance in this story, anyway, of them going through a wall or a window or anything like that. If you got those powers, why do you need to drag somebody, you know? But
I want to
first guys
information didn't. Here, too, that he, although his toes were bouncing along the rocks, and I used the word drag, his arms were out, and he did have a floating sensation. So it appears he was being escorted, but his feet were dragging
him. Ah, okay. That makes sense. Well, you two both stay with us. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you. Our two special guests tonight, Kathleen Martin, Stanton Friedman. We're talking about two of their works, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, and Science Was Wrong. So we'll open up your phone lines in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM when we come back right at the top. Stanton's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. It's stantonfriedman.com. And Kathleen Martin's website, there's a dash between Kathleen and Martin, MARDEN.com. Kathleen, before we go to calls with you and Stanton, tell me about the section about extraordinary visual feats, the size phenomena. And you talk about the plight of Natasha Demkina.
Yes, Natasha Demkina was a young Russian medical intuitive who claimed that she could see the full structure of the human body, including how internal organs are positioned and how they function. It was as if she almost had X-ray eyes. And this ability came upon her quite by accident after she'd had surgery for appendicitis. And one day she looked at her mother, and she didn't really understand at that time what she was observing. But over time, she came to realize that she could actually see diseased organs inside human beings. And she became very well known in Russia for this. And the news traveled internationally. And she had a great deal of success in some anecdotal type scientific studies. Nothing with really good protocols set, although later on she did have success with that as well. But the Discovery Channel produced a television program in 2004, which was allegedly designed to test Natasha's paranormal ability in an objective and unbiased manner. She was told that she was going to be tested by some of the top scientists in the world. And so she was very excited about this to prove that she actually had this gift. Actually, there were three members of SICOP, now CSI, the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, who had designed this test for television. And it was designed in a way to increase her chance of failure. It was done differently from the normal protocols that Natasha followed. She was subjected to stress. She was suffering from jet lag. She was treated in a hostile way. She wasn't able to read the people in this experiment in the way that she normally does, and the team raised the bar for success. So even though she had very significant findings in this, she was deemed to have failed it because they had raised the bar on what was acceptable, not what was internationally acceptable, but what they determined would be okay with them as being acceptable. And we know that not all psychics are 100% successful. They have some good days and they have some bad days.
That's right.
And certain things such as sleep deprivation, the environment that they're in, and that sort of thing can reduce their chances of success.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. In the end, Nobel Prize-winning physicist and the director of the University of Cambridge's Mind-Matter Unification Project, Brian Josephson, ended up criticizing the experimental team's methodology and questioned their motives publicly, along with a number of other scientists and an international well-known lawyer who went to bat for Natasha over this.
Okay, now we go to the phones. You ready?
Yep.
Here we go. We'll go to Doug, first-time caller in St. Louis. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I've been listening to your program forever. This is the first time I've ever called in. It's really a great program.
Thanks, Doug.
I had a question for Mr. Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
I see from his website that he used to work on fission and fusion rockets, and that brings to mind somebody else that I heard of, Dr. Robert Bussard, who used to do the same thing. And I was wondering what Mr. Friedman thought of his work on that and the project that he was working on for the Navy right before he died on his inertial electrodynamic fusion project.
Well, there's a major difference here. We use the terms fission and fusion quite readily, but Bussard's rocket, the basic idea was, why carry along fuel when you can gather it along the way? Now, outer space is quite close to a perfect vacuum, but there is still hydrogen out there. And if you're going real fast and have a big collector in front of you, you can gather up some of this hydrogen and kick it out the back end with strong acceleration so that you add to the velocity of the rocket and keep going. And part of this is if you use hydrogen isotopes, then you can create fusion as opposed to fission. My work was in sort of in a different direction. When I was working on fission rockets for Westinghouse, we built and tested them on the ground, we in Los Alamos and Aerojet General. And well, the biggest one was operated by Los Alamos. Here we have a nuclear reactor that's less than 7 feet in diameter, putting out a power of 4,400 megawatts. That's twice the output of Grand Coulee Dam in something 7 feet in diameter. Quite remarkable. Tested not too far from Area 51. That was back in the 60s, and of course the program was canceled. Nuclear fusion, what I had looked at was in the early 60s at Aerojet General Nucleonics, with the man who had been in charge of the fusion work at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, John Luce. And what we found was that if you use the right stuff in the right way, deuterium and helium-3, that's heavy hydrogen that I mentioned in the cold fusion work, and helium-3, if you react those two isotopes, you can produce 10 million times as much energy per particle as you can get in a chemical rocket. And the stuff that you produce are charged particles, which are influenced by electric and magnetic fields, so you can kick them all out the back end of the rocket, and off you go into the universe. And that's very exciting work. And, of course, it can't be done cheaply. You know, you want to build one. If you got enough dough, you probably could, but who's got that kind of money? So Bussard was looking from a different direction, so to speak, than John Luce was, or the national, the fission reactor kind of stuff that they did at Westinghouse in Los Alamos. So good man, interesting idea, and again, the kicker here is progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. That laser is not just the better light bulb. Different physics.
Sure is. Okay, thanks for that. Let's go to Glenn in Harlington, Texas, east of the Rockies. Glenn, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. I have a question for Stanton.
Sure.
Stanton, did you work on the Convair NB36H test program?
I was working at General Electric and doing experiments down at Convair Fort Worth. And so these are radiation shielding experiments. We had a small reactor, actually quite similar to the one that was carried on the B-36. And I do want to correct a false impression that many people have had that that B-36 was powered by a nuclear reactor. It definitely was not. It's an immense airplane, incidentally, and a small reactor.
I'm looking at a beautiful artist rendering of it right now.
Well, the thing is that the reactor, you know, there were plans and schemes and ideas and so forth, but there was a nuclear reactor operated on board a B-36 to produce radiation for shielding experiments. If you vary the altitude, you vary the density of the air, of course, and that affects the amount of radiation that gets scattered that leaves the reactor heading off not toward the pilot, but then gets scattered toward him. And so you need how do you do an experiment up in the air, you know, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 feet? And so they did run a series of these runs out over the Gulf, guys made good money because they would sleep on the way out and then do their experiments and sleep on the way back. But
my spec sheet says the crew capsule weighed 11 tons thanks to the lead and rubber lining and protective water shield.
Well, yeah, this wasn't a performance shield at all. It was to protect the crew of the plane from the reactor. But it had really nothing to do with the propulsion of the airplane. So the aircraft nuclear propulsion program carried on in mostly in the 50s, and especially between 1956 and 1960. I worked on that for 3 years at General Electric. And in 1958, we spent $100 million. That's what I was saying before. We employed 3,500 people. 1,100 of them were engineers and scientists. And we never operated a flying airplane on nuclear power. We learned a lot of interesting experiments, exciting program.
Are you disappointed that with our fascination with all things nuclear in the 50s, we didn't go ahead and build a proper space station and a proper space-faring, solar system-faring?
Yes, I am disappointed indeed. The fission rocket makes a good upper stage for a rocket if you want to go to Mars. Why is the space station using solar panels, these huge things, when a small reactor would do the job much better and weigh a lot less? There's been a lack of, how shall I put this, guts and courage. When it came time to fish or cut bait, we always cut bait. We needed more Admiral Rickovers, and we didn't have them in the rocket business as we did in the nuclear submarine business. We have a whole fleet of nuclear submarines and nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. And, you know, the startling statistic, a nuclear-powered carrier can operate for 18 years without refueling. That's a very impressive number. Yet, we didn't use it for most of the space program. We used radioisotope thermoelectric generators for the Pioneer spacecraft, Voyager, Viking, some of them. And the kicker is the Russians operated more than 35 reactors in space. We operated one. They had more power available for sideband radar and for particle beam weapons and all this kind of stuff. The failure to follow up on our leads in these things is really it bothers me. What a waste of opportunities we had. We should be leading, not following.
That's true. And Kathleen, when you were looking at all of the Betty Hill's memorabilia tapes and everything, was there anything that you came across that you found to be probably the most fascinating of the lot?
The information on the hypnosis tapes I found was fascinating because I had never had access to this. The information did not appear in the interrupted journey, and it really gave me a great deal of insight into Betty's and Barney's personalities, psychology, and history. So I found that to be very, very fascinating. In addition to that, letters to and from highly respected scientists who were very interested in what happened to Betty and Barney, and all of this was being done undercover by scientists who really didn't want their names to be associated with UFO abduction. And I found that there was a great deal of interest and support in this.
Quietly, though.
Those letters to be fascinating.
Did Betty ever explain to you what she truly felt, what she thinks happened to herself beyond under hypnosis?
I, at the end of Betty's life, interviewed her, and I did the type of interview, you know, several days over a period of time, where I wanted to take her step by step. Betty had, of course, over the years, developed a spiel on what happened to her, and she would go into what happened at a certain point. And I stopped her, and they said, no, I've heard all of that before. I don't want to hear that. Listen to me. I want you to describe moment by moment what happened to you. And we went through that together, and I tape recorded that. It was very emotionally difficult for Betty to go back and to actually remember what she was going through at any moment.
I should mention here that one of the things that Kathleen found was a statement from Dr. Simon that the emotional intensity as Betty and Barty relived their experiences under hypnosis was every bit as great as that of any of the shell shock war veterans that he had treated. And he had to stop, what was it, one session each, I guess, because he couldn't, he didn't think they could handle the emotional intensity. We're not talking about casual experience here, in other words.
Okay, let's go to Angelina, Toronto, Canada. Go ahead, Angelina.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I'd like to make a comment about Betty and then ask Stantman a question. I believe they went through something real, but I believe it was all staged. I've had somebody in the government tell me that they're the actors. And, and I believe that's what it was. And I wanted to ask Stanton ever heard that there was a flying saucer built in Malta, which is just outside the airport in Toronto in 1953.
Of course, the Avro car. As a matter of fact, there were two of them around. One of them is standing at the entrance to a museum down in the States and one in Canada. But it didn't fly like a saucer.
No, there's the plane and then there's the flying saucer. There were two different things.
Well, there were all kinds of planes at that facility, but the flying saucer was the Avro car, and there were supposed to be more of them later on. It didn't work very well. It didn't get more than a few feet off the ground. Yes, Avro built, matter of fact, one of the saddest comments about Canadian defense programs was that they clobbered the most advanced fighter in the world was cut up. The United States had protested. It's a long story. But that wasn't a flying saucer. It was that shape. But it certainly wasn't something that could duplicate the behavior of the saucers that Betty and Barney saw, the saucer, singular, and all the others that have been seen over the years all over the place. The ability to go very fast, very high, fly vertically, make right-angle turns, reverse, land in the middle of nowhere. Sorry, it doesn't cut it.
How would you rate the Travis Walton case with the case of Barney and Betty Hill?
Well, it's interesting. They're both together told in the same movie, UFOs Are Real, which I did way back in 79. I've spent time with Travis. I've been at his home, met his family. We've done television programs together. We met at places like Turkey and Brazil. I'm very much satisfied, especially after talking to Coral and Jim Lorenzen of APRO, that Travis was indeed abducted on board a craft, a very different experience from the Hill case. He was not an intentional abductee. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Zappo.
Absolutely. He's been on the program before, and I think the guy's authentic. We'll be back in a moment with final calls on Coast to Coast AM. Stan, would you say that the Barney and Betty Hill case, one of the best abduction cases out there?
No question. No question. Partly because Dr. Simon was unique in terms of the people who were investigating such cases. He ran a hospital with 3,000 beds for veterans,
yeah.
PTSD now we'd say, but then it was shell shock. He knew what he was doing. He didn't know much about UFOs, but he sure knew how to help people who'd had a traumatic experience that they couldn't recall. And that's very important. He was an expert.
Okay, let's go to final calls. Wickenburg, Arizona, first of all. It's Robert, west of the Rockies. Hey, Robert, go ahead.
Hey, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Excuse me, Norrie, for taking my call. Your screener for letting me get through. I'd like to ask Mr. Freeman a question. This goes back to about April of 2008 when he was doing the promo the night of he presented his new book called Flying Saucers and Science. And Mr. Freeman, at the end of the hour, made a statement that I've never heard him mention since, and I'd like to ask him if he got any further information on it. He said, I think he said that the microwave energy has something to do with the operation of these flying saucers, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. What I was talking about was a process called magneto-aerodynamics, where you ionize the air, make it electrically conducting. That's what happens when a meteor comes into the atmosphere. That glowing stuff is ionized air, and you can use microwaves to do that. And if you have electric and magnetic field production capabilities, then you can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, all the stuff that has to do with the performance of saucers, of anything in the air, as a matter of fact. And when I had a literature search done way back in about 1970, I guess, of industrial work, government reports, I had 900 responses to the keyword magneto-aerodynamics. 90% of these documents were classified. So there was a lot of work looking at this. And again, it's not cheap. It's not easy. You have to know what you're doing. It takes great care. But microwaves are one way. There are other ways, but it's a quick way of breaking down the air so that you can ionize, so you can interact with the electromagnetic fields. The electromagnetic submarine using seawater as the electrically conducting fluid, that was built in the mid-60s, and it worked, and the Japanese built one, and it worked, small one. Hasn't been pursued for Lord knows why, but it's the same basic idea. Electric and magnetic fields at right angles produce a force at right angles to both. You push against the seawater, it pushes back. In the air, you ionize the air, you push against the ionized air, it pushes back. Newton's laws, which do work. And so it's a whole entirely different approach to flight. Not carrying along something you throw out the back end.
Kathleen, you know, we were just talking about Natasha in some of these feats. Discovery, I think back in 2004 or so, did a show on her. Anything new since then with her?
There were follow-up experiments in Japan. She passed with flying colors. And she ended up going to what is sort of like a medical school in Russia and is, as far as I know, currently working as a medical intuitive in this Russian institute. So her ability is recognized as being legitimate in Russia.
There was a woman named Dr. Shafika Karagula.
That was my aunt.
You're kidding.
No, I'm serious.
Okay, well, she's written an exciting book about how she knew what was wrong with her patients when they came in. She ran the test.
Breakthrough to creativity.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
That was your aunt.
Yes.
What a small world.
On my dad's side.
Okay.
It is.
And what I'm saying is that Natasha is not a trained medical person. Shafika was. And she, after the book came out, apparently she got loads of letters from other doctors who said they could do the same thing, but they sure weren't talking about it.
Exactly. She died strangely, Stanton. A radio fell in her tub.
You're kidding.
Well, that's
wow.
Just a bizarre way to go.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Kyle in Las Vegas, Nevada. Go ahead, Kyle.
Hi, guys. Hi, George.
Hey.
I was born in Roswell and raised in Arizona. I just wanted to thank Dr. Friedman for all that he's done to advance public awareness of the Roswell community and talk about what the Four Corners kids are bringing up these days about science.
Well, you're very welcome. It's not doctor, it's mister. I'll accept the honorary degree. And I will be in Roswell first week of July.
A couple weeks coming up.
Too. Yeah, coming up very soon. And we will each be giving lectures at the museum. There will be this press conference on July 2nd about a movie called Magic Men that somebody will play me and somebody will play Don Schmidt, and we'll talk about Roswell and MJ-12 and top secret magic and stuff like that. We don't have all the details yet, but I'm looking forward to that. And, you know, anybody who's coming to Roswell, be sure to carry some stuff to protect you against sunburn. It was 108 the other day there.
Oh, my gosh. Somebody wants Dreyfuss to play you, Richard Dreyfuss.
Oh, that's a good idea. I like that.
Well, that's not bad at all. All right, Kyle, thanks. Let's go to Dennis in St. Louis. You're up with us. Go ahead, Dennis.
Yes, good morning. When you were talking about where science got it wrong, during the development of the atomic bomb, one of the detractors to the bomb itself was the head of the Ordnance Department or something like that. He said he didn't believe the thing would work.
Oh, there were several people, and we talk about that in the book. Admiral Leahy, who was an expert on explosives. Truman's advisor on that sort of stuff. He said, you know, it was a damn fool thing, and he was an expert on explosives. Of course it wouldn't work. What are you going to say?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's who I was trying to think of. Okay, thank you, Mr. Freeman.
You're very welcome.
There you go. Next up, we'll go to Larry, truck driving in Michigan, first-time caller. Larry, you are up.
How are you doing, George?
Okay.
I just wanted to say thank you for taking Coast to a whole new level. You and your staff have done a fantastic job. And in my opinion, the two people who have brought the whole UFO experiences to the forefront has been Eric Von Daniken, of course, and Mr. Stan Freeman. And I just wanted to say thank you to Stan for having the courage to do the research and bring it out to the public and stand by his word and let everybody know the truth. And that's all I wanted to say. Just thank you.
You're very welcome.
There you go. Text in from Kenny in St. Louis wants to know, either one of you can answer this, do you believe God and aliens to be one and the same?
Oh, boy. Flip a coin. I don't think they're the same. I like the Pope's comment. If he made us, he could have made aliens, too. So we're all part of brethren in space.
Yeah.
I'll stop there and without getting into the religious argument.
How about you?
Aliens are gods.
I agree with Stan on that. I think that aliens are more comparable to humans, although they're very different from us in a sense. But I do like the Pope's statement that if God created life on Earth, why not elsewhere in the universe as well?
Did Betty ever question what they wanted with her and her husband?
She seemed to know that what they wanted to do, and Barney was of the same opinion, was to determine the differences between human beings and themselves. They were very interested in Betty and Barney's skeletal structures, for example. Our joints, our bone structure, is very different from the ETs that Betty and Barney encountered. Our mouths, for example, are very different. These ETs did not have teeth. There was a membrane inside the mouth that fluttered when they spoke among themselves in sort of a humming or buzzing kind of language that Betty and Barney understood telepathically. So they were really interested in the differences between themselves and human beings.
Okay, we go to Rochester, New Hampshire. Alex is with us. Go ahead, Alex.
Yes, I want to thank everyone, George and Stanton and Kathleen, for doing the show. I really appreciate it. I met you, Kathleen, in Farmington, New Hampshire, when you gave a presentation about your book, Captured. Also, I believe Stan Friedman wrote the introduction, I believe. Anyhow, I met you at the library, and later spoke with you on the phone about a UFO sighting. But the reason I'm calling is there is an art exhibit in Rochester, New Hampshire. It's a temporary public art exhibition where there's 20 different sites that people can walk to downtown. And one of them includes, it's titled Happened, and it's about the Betty and Barney Hill story. I thought you might be interested. Huh. And there's there's two aspects to each site, and this particular site, which covers the story, has kind of like a painting as well as a poem. And the painting, I believe, does justice to the story, giving it credibility. I myself believe what happened to Betty and Barty Hill. But the poem itself, it does sort of cast this sort of idea that it was sort of a delusion or a projection on Betty and Barney Hill's part. I'll just recite a brief part of the poem that says, The godly see angels, the alienated see aliens. How reassuring to know their ships will open to receive. Their proddings will ward off the loneliness of being an interracial couple in the 60s. That's just a part of the poem, but you get the idea that it kind of doubts the veracity of their story. And I was born in New Hampshire, grew up in New Hampshire. I'm familiar with the White Mountains area. I never met Betty or Barney Hill, but the idea, the belief, the fact that they were an interracial couple in the 60s in New Hampshire, which is predominantly white, I think, in my opinion, adds credibility to their story, because it's my understanding that Barney Hill was a member of the NAACP, and it's my understanding from the readings I've done that he was very reluctant to come forward because he didn't want to do damage to that cause. And the fact that he did eventually come forward with the story, I think, speaks to his credibility and to the credibility of the story in general.
That's a good point, Alex. Very good. What do you think? Kathleen, let's start with you on that.
Well, that's very true. Betty and Barney, first of all, were not alienated. They were very proactive and very involved in the civil rights movement. In fact, Barney was appointed by the governor of New Hampshire to serve on the committee, State Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. He was well known throughout the state. And Betty and Barney did not have an interest in UFOs or aliens before they had this experience in the White Mountains. So whoever wrote the poem was not familiar with the characteristics of Betty and Barney. The exhibit sounds interesting, though. And I'm living in Florida, but I'm going to be in New Hampshire in August. I'll be there in September for the second Exeter, New Hampshire UFO Festival, which will take place over Labor Day weekend. Stan, in fact, is going to be speaking there. I'll just be attending and autographing books and that sort of thing. But it would be interesting if it's still in Rochester to go up and visit the exhibit.
Kathleen, do you make these tapes of Betty and Barney Hill available?
I make them available to scientists and to mental health professionals who want to come to my house to listen to them. I have a written directive from Betty as the executor of her estate, the trustee of her estate, that she did not want them distributed to the public. This is personal medical information. It's confidential. But I do make it available to people who normally do have access to that type of information.
Would we...
For training purposes.
Would we be disrespecting what she wanted if we played a few minutes of it one night? Maybe you could make it available?
Are excerpts that I have made available. It doesn't include the information, the personal
stuff, right.
The sexual information, that sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah, maybe we can do that. We'll have our producers call you back and have you and Stan come back and maybe just play a few minutes of one.
Sounds great.
Okay, we'll do that.
I do play the tapes. Excerpts from the tapes when I lecture on the Betty and Barney Hill UFO incident, which I will be doing in Roswell in July, and also, I won't be doing it at the MUFON International Symposium. I'll be speaking on the conundrum of alien abduction there.
Stan, in just a few minutes we have, we'll take final calls, but where do we get the book Science Was Wrong and also Captured?
Well, both, of course, through the Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com and all that stuff. Or from the one advantage of getting them from myself or from Kathleen is you get books autographed by both of us. We use book plates. We don't send the books back and forth. And from my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, or you can send a check. You can go there, and you can send a check to Post Office Box 958, Holton, beautiful downtown Holton, Maine, 04730-0958, including priority mail postage. It's 1995. And Kathleen has it available, too. Why don't you give your information, Kathleen?
Yes, it is on my website at www.kathleen-marden.com. It's available, both books, sent priority mail, the same as Stan's. And you can use a credit card to purchase it from my site, or you can send a check or money order to me. And it is at P.O. Box 120172, Claremont, C-L-E-R-M-O-N-T, Florida, 34712. Captured is 1899, and Science Was Wrong is 1999.
I've got visions of Stan, of you walking through Holton, Maine with a bag full of checks back into Canada from all your book sales.
Got to stop at the border now.
You never know.
It's a lot easier to do it from Maine than it is to cross the border with the books and stuff, and the mail service a lot better.
Stan, we got a minute left. Are we going to get disclosure at all in this country?
Well, I'm waiting for that book. I think we will, but I think it's not going to come right away. There are serious problems with how you do this, and you don't want to upset the world. It's already in an upset point, and it's got to be handled properly. We don't have much experience at bringing something like this, so I won't say catastrophic, but so with so much impact on all areas of our society, we don't know how to do that very well. So I'm trying to educate people so they'll be ready. Somebody asked me why I'm still alive. How come you haven't been shot for talking about Cosmic Watergate? I said, maybe I'm doing what they want done, get more and more people aware that there's something going on, so when disclosure does come, we're more ready for it.
Absolutely. Stan, thank you so much. Kathleen as well. Both of them miraculous people, aren't they? For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.